Today we are tackling a topic that, it sounds a little mundane on the surface, simple accounting really, but is actually one of the most high-stakes, compliance-heavy risks an investor faces. We're talking about the security deposit.
It's the perfect Trojan horse of property management, isn't it? Every landlord collects a deposit, maybe a month or two of rent, holds it, and, fully intends to return it. What could possibly go wrong? Well, if you're operating in the Kansas City metro area, straddling that Kansas and Missouri state line, the answer is virtually everything.
Right.
Because you are dealing with two fundamentally different sets of state laws simultaneously.
Exactly. And that's our mission today, to give you, the investor, a crucial compliance shortcut. We're going to break down exactly what Kansas and Missouri law requires for collecting, holding, and then returning those deposits. And we're going to focus on the really rigorous, systematic approach that a company like Alpine Property Management uses. Their material gives us the blueprint, and we want to show you why handling deposits correctly is just, it's non-negotiable. It protects your investment, helps you avoid some ruinous legal exposure, and it's key to fostering good tenant relationships.
This deep dive isn't just about, reading the statute out loud. It's about understanding the consequences of what happens when you fail. The sources make it really clear that professional security deposit management is maybe the single most regulated and honestly the most commonly misunderstood part of the entire rental life cycle. Investors have to stop viewing this as just some administrative chore.
Yeah.
You have to start treating it as the critical, legally sensitive procedure that it absolutely is.
Okay, so let's start right there with the regulatory stakes. Because I think a lot of DIY or, novice landlords, they treat the security deposit like it's some kind of emergency fund that they control. They drop it into their general operating account and they just figure, oh, I'll use it to fix any damage later.
And that right there is the single biggest, most financially risky assumption in the industry. It's called commingling funds.
Right.
Commingling is mixing the tenant's money, which legally, we have to be clear, is not the landlord's money yet.
Not yet.
With the landlord's personal or operating funds. If you do that in a state like Missouri, you have already violated state law. It doesn't matter how well you manage the property otherwise. You've broken the law.
It sounds like such a simple accounting mistake, but what is the actual financial risk of mishandling these funds, even if it's an accident, like missing a statutory deadline by one day?
The risk is, I'd say it's existential. We are not talking about a small fine here. In many cases, in both states, mishandling a deposit, failing to return it on time, failing to provide the right itemization, or improperly holding the funds can lead to the court awarding the tenant two or sometimes even three times the amount of the original deposit.
Wow.
Plus court costs and the tenant's attorney fees.
Wait, hold on. Let me unpack that. So if I collected, say, a $1,500 deposit and I missed the Kansas return deadline by just 48 hours, I could be forced to pay that tenant $4,500 plus potentially thousands more in legal fees, all for an administrative slip-up.
Precisely. That is the gravity of the mistake. That one penalty instantly erases any potential profit margin you had on that property for the entire year, maybe longer. For an investor, it turns what should be a smooth, profitable transaction into a catastrophic legal liability.
And beyond just the immediate financial hit, the source material talks about the collateral damage. The loss of reputation.
Reputation is currency today. It just is. If a former tenant wins a huge judgment against a landlord, or even just leaves a really detailed, frustrated story online about an unfairly withheld deposit, that significantly harms that landlord's ability to attract the next tenant, especially a high-quality, responsible tenant.
Because good tenants do their homework.
They do their research. They want to be treated fairly.
And for investors here in the Kansas City region, the focus has to be laser sharp on that dual compliance piece.
Absolutely. Just think about the complexity for a second. You might live out in the suburbs, right near the state line. Maybe you own one duplex in Overland Park, Kansas, and a fourplex just across the river in Independence, Missouri.
Right.
You're managing, let's say, $1,800 deposits in both places. But the timeline for returning them, the maximum amount you can even collect, and how you legally have to store that money, it's all different. If you try to apply one rule set, say, the Missouri standard to your Kansas property, you're at risk of being non-compliant, and vice versa.
That complexity really just screams out for a professional system. If you're trying to do this with spreadsheets and calendar reminders, the margin for error seems astronomical.
It is. The core message here is that relying on a professional management company like Alpine provides a crucial legal firewall. Their entire system is built on structure and legal guidance. It's designed not just to process money, but to create auditable, defensible documentation. This is what ensures compliance, fairness, transparency, and it protects the owner's legal standing from the second that lease is signed until the final refund check clears. For them, compliance isn't a suggestion. It's the foundation of their entire service.
So we've established the stakes. This is not just optional paperwork. This is a critical, high-risk legal procedure. Now let's get into the nitty-gritty of those dual state laws.
Let's do it. Let's dissect the rules, because these differences are, they're subtle, but they are exactly where non-professional landlords most often stumble into really costly errors.
All right, so we're going to jump across the state line, and we'll start with Kansas. Mm-hmm. For investors with properties on the west side of the metro, what are the caps on how much you can collect, and what are those non-negotiable, very fast-approaching deadlines for return?
Kansas provides really clear limits on collection, which is helpful, but you're right. Their return timeline is incredibly strict and, frankly, unforgiving.
Okay. So for an unfurnished property in Kansas, the law sets a firm ceiling. You can collect up to 1 month's rent for the deposit. If the property is furnished, that cap rises a little bit, allowing you to collect up to 1.5 months' rent.
And that little half-month difference for furnished properties, it seems minor, but it's a detail that a professional system has to track meticulously. If you mistakenly collect 1.5 months' rent for an unfurnished unit, you've over-collected. And you might have to refund that excess immediately or risk a claim from the tenant.
And then pets had another layer on top of that. Kansas allows an additional half month's rent for a pet deposit if you have one. So if we run the numbers on a, let's say, a high-end scenario, a furnished unit with a pet, you could legally collect 2 months' worth of rent. But it's broken down as the 1.5 month base deposit plus that half month pet deposit.
And that distinction is vital. While the total amount you collect might equal what Missouri allows, the legal categories are different. For Kansas investors, I think the key takeaway is that your baseline collection limit is lower, which makes detailed financial screening of your tenants even more important because your immediate financial buffer is smaller.
Now for the time crunch. This is the true compliance trap in Kansas, right?
Yeah.
The timeline for the return or the accounting is famously complex. The landlord has to return the deposit or provide the itemized deductions within 14 days of determining those deductions.
Yeah.
Or within 30 days of move out.
Whichever comes first.
That whichever comes first clause.
Yeah.
That is a compliance killer for anyone running an unsystematic operation. Let's create a common scenario to illustrate the danger here. Say a tenant moves out on May 1st. The property manager or the DIY landlord, they get busy, but they manage to do the move out inspection and damage assessment on, say, May 15th. That's 14 days after move out, and they determine deductions need to be made.
So if the determination happens on May 15th, does that mean the 14-day clock starts from that determination? Well, this is where the interpretation matters, and it's so tricky. The statute says the landlord has to return it or itemize within 14 days after the determination of the amount to be withheld, or within 30 days after the termination of the tenancy, whichever occurs first.
Okay, so if the tenant moves out on day one, and the landlord doesn't even get around to starting the inspection until day 20, the final deadline is still day 30, because that's the ceiling from the termination date.
Correct. The 30-day clock is always running in the background. But if that property manager is really on top of it and they finish the inspection and determine the damages on day 10, they now have 14 days from that determination. That makes their final deadline day 24. They cannot wait until day 30. This means you have to have an incredibly swift, structured process. The key takeaway for a system like Alpine's is that they aim to complete that determination much, much sooner than 30 days. They guarantee that if they determine it on day 7, they are ready to refund or itemize by day 21, well ahead of that statutory maximum. Improvised documentation will just not work here.
It really demands immediate action. And the final piece in Kansas is the itemization requirement. Any funds you withhold had to be itemized in writing and sent to the tenant along with any remaining balance, and it has to be detailed and defensible.
Defensible is the key word. It is not enough to just write damage to walls $500. No.
Yeah.
You need repair and replacement of 4x4-inch drywall hole in master bedroom, $350. Repaint 2 damaged walls with color match paint, $150. That level of detail must be supported by the documentation that we're going to talk about.
Okay, so let's cross the state line now into Missouri. The rules here offer a higher collection cap, but they seem to impose much stricter procedural requirements on how the money is handled during the tenancy.
Yes. Missouri offers more financial protection for the landlord up front. Landlords there can collect up to 2 months' rent for the security deposit. That's significantly higher than Kansas's baseline of 1 month for unfurnished properties. So that larger buffer is a key financial benefit for Missouri investors.
And the return timeline is, I would say, arguably simpler. The deposit must be returned within a strict 30 days after the lease termination. There's no secondary 14 days from determination clause to complicate things.
Right. But the trade-off for that clear 30-day window is that Missouri layers on these crucial procedural and accounting requirements that are absolute compliance tripwires.
Let's discuss the first one, which you already mentioned. The deposit has to be held in a separate federally insured account. It cannot be mixed or commingled with rent, operational funds, or the landlord's personal money.
This is completely non-negotiable in Missouri, and like I said, it is the single biggest failure point for cross-border or DIY investors. If you use a single bank account for all your rental income and expenses, you are instantly violating Missouri law. That money is legally the tenant's until they forfeit it through damages or non-payment.
I have a challenging question on this, based on the critique. If Missouri requires a federally insured account, can a manager just use any local credit union? Or does it need to be a major national bank? And what evidence do you have to provide to the tenant that this account is, in fact, separate?
That's an excellent question. It gets right to the heart of the structure, the federally insured part. That typically means any bank or credit union that's covered by the FDIC or the NCUA is acceptable. What really matters is the nature of the account. It has to be structured as a dedicated trust account or an escrow account. It must be specifically designated for tenant deposits. For a professional manager like Alpine, this account is set up legally to hold client funds. It's often called a client trust account. As for proof, while the law doesn't necessarily say you have to send the tenant the account number, the professional standard demands transparency. If a dispute ever arises, the property manager must be able to immediately show the chain of custody for that specific deposit.
Show the paper trail.
Exactly. Show it went directly into the segregated trust account and was never, ever commingled. That level of auditability is what protects the owner.
That distinction, an auditable trust account versus just a separate checking account, that's huge. The second critical procedural requirement in Missouri is the move-out inspection. The tenant has to be offered the opportunity to be present.
This procedural step is designed specifically to preempt legal disputes. By offering the tenant the chance to walk through the property with the manager, the landlord is signaling transparency. The manager isn't acting like a judge, but as an assessor of facts. If the tenant attends, they see the damage in real time. Maybe they even agree to the charges right there. But if the tenant chooses not to attend, the owner has still fulfilled the legal requirement to offer the opportunity. And this procedural compliance shields the owner from later claims that the damage assessment was unfair or done in secret.
So even if the tenant just skips the inspection, the owner has complied with the letter of the law simply by sending that written offer.
Exactly. And a system like Alpine's uses certified mail or some kind of electronic confirmation to prove that the offer to attend the move-out inspection was made in a timely manner. It creates yet another layer of documentary protection for the owner.
And finally, just like in Kansas, written itemization of any deductions for damages or unpaid rent is mandatory in Missouri.
So when we compare these two states side by side, you can really see why non-professional management is so dangerous. The devil is truly in these small details.
Absolutely. That separate account requirement in Missouri is the immediate financial risk. If an investor owns properties in both states and uses a single account just for convenience, they're legally compliant in Kansas, but immediately non-compliant in Missouri. They've created unnecessary legal exposure just through a faulty accounting structure.
And the timelines are a huge source of administrative error. I mean, trying to manually track that fluctuating 14-30-day timeline in Kansas, while at the same time adhering to the strict 30-day timeline and all the procedural requirements in Missouri, if you don't have a systemized automated protocol, you're guaranteed to make mistakes.
The consequences are so severe. I remember an anecdotal case in the sources, a DIY landlord in Liberty, Missouri, who lost 2 months' rent over a $400 cleaning dispute. And it was simply because they failed to prove the funds were segregated. It rendered the entire deposit forfeit. The underlying dispute was tiny, But the compliance failure was massive.
That is the perfect illustration. The failure wasn't the damage assessment. It was the failure to follow the statutory process.
Mm-hmm.
These small legal differences are exactly where the non-professional landlord makes these costly but entirely avoidable errors. It necessitates relying on a standardized system that's sophisticated enough to handle the nuances of both state statutes with absolute precision.
Which brings us to the practical solution. How does a professional team actually manage this high-stakes, dual-compliance process? The source material details Alpine's five-step lifecycle, which is explicitly designed to create airtight records that are legally defensible under scrutiny.
And the foundational philosophy here is sound. The deposit process is treated as a legal procedure. It's supported by documentation, never based on opinion or assumption. This structured approach is fundamental to protecting the owner.
Okay, step one. Transparent collection at move-in. The protection starts with transparency. When the tenant signs the lease, the Alpine team clearly explains the amount, the purpose, and the legal terms of the deposit. This front-loads clarity to eliminate confusion down the road.
Clarity up front is so vital. If the tenant understands the exact conditions under which their deposit might be withheld, including specific examples of what counts as excessive damage, they are much less likely to challenge the process when they move out. Transparency reduces friction.
And the crucial compliance step happens immediately upon collection. Deposits are collected electronically and immediately placed into those dedicated, segregated trust accounts. This ensures complete compliance with all the state separation laws, especially that strict Missouri requirement against commingling.
The immediate electronic segregation just removes human error from the equation. The moment the funds are received, they are legally separated from the operating revenue. This means the investor never has to worry about that legal violation of commingling, which is a key source of liability in the Missouri market. The deposit's chain of custody is established from day one. It's auditable and it's defensible.
Okay, step two, proper documentation and inspection. This is where you establish the baseline. This step is the investor's insurance policy. Before the tenant ever even gets the keys, a detailed property inspection is conducted, documented meticulously with high-resolution photos, videos, and written notes.
This establishes the legally sound baseline condition report. Without clear, dated, objective evidence of the property's condition before tenancy, any future claim for damages is just a verbal dispute. It's he said, she said. In court, the documented baseline wins every single time.
And we're not just talking about a quick iPhone photo of each room, are we? We're talking about comprehensive media files that cover every room, every appliance, every single surface.
Precisely. We need visual proof of the pristine condition of the carpet, the absence of holes in the walls, the functionality of the fixtures. This documentation serves a dual purpose. It protects the owner from claims that pre-existing damage should be covered by the deposit, and it equally protects the tenant from being unfairly charged for wear and tear that existed when they moved in. It creates fairness through verifiable facts. If a tenant moves out and claims, oh, those carpet stains were there before, the manager can instantly provide dated evidence from the baseline report. It minimizes ambiguity and dramatically lowers the probability of a successful legal challenge against the owner.
All right, step three, responsible deposit management during the tenancy. Once that deposit is sitting in the trust account, the task shifts to ongoing accountability and auditing throughout the entire lease term.
This continuous management ensures that the fund segregation is maintained, not just at the beginning, but continuously. Key functions involve keeping funds strictly separate from rent revenue, tracking tenant ledgers for full transparency, and providing owners with access to financial reports through their property management portal.
That owner portal access seems really key. It means investors aren't just taking the manager's word for it. They can actually see the accounting trail themselves.
Absolutely. That layer of auditability is crucial. If an investor, or maybe their accountant, ever questions the handling of funds, the segregated ledger is immediately available and traceable. This professional accountability protects the owner from any accusations of financial impropriety or misuse. It fulfills the spirit of the separate account law, even beyond just the physical segregation of the money.
Okay. Step four. Thorough move-out inspections and damage assessment. This is the high-risk moment. A comprehensive move-out inspection is performed, using new photos and videos, and comparing the current state of the property against that baseline report from step two.
And this comparison is the critical phase. This is where the legal standard meets real-world application. The manager has to accurately distinguish between two legally distinct categories: normal wear and tear versus excessive damage. This is where most DIY landlords make really costly legal mistakes, trying to deduct costs that are legally their own responsibility.
Let's delve into some technical examples here, because this is the level of detail investors need to hear. What specifically constitutes normal wear and tear that you absolutely cannot deduct for?
Normal wear and tear is basically property appreciation through regular expected use. Think about minor scuffs where a couch rubbed against the wall, faded paint from sunlight exposure, maybe some minor yellowing of vinyl flooring, or just simple carpet aging in high traffic areas. The law recognizes that a property is not new forever.
And crucially, we have to consider the depreciation schedule, right? If a landlord installed brand new carpet, which is generally given a life expectancy of, say, 7 years, and a tenant spills red wine on it in year six, the landlord can't charge the tenant for the cost of a brand new carpet replacement, correct?
That is precisely correct. This is the sophisticated compliance detail. The deduction for damage has to be reasonable, and it must account for the age and expected life of that item. If the carpet was 6 years old, with only 1 year of life remaining, the maximum a landlord could legally deduct for its replacement is only the depreciated value, about 1/7 of the replacement cost, not the full price. Deductions can only be made for excessive damage, the holes, the intentional abuse, the pet destruction that drastically shortens the life expectancy of that item.
So the property manager needs to be an expert not just in state law, but also in item depreciation schedules to make sure the itemization is legally fair and defensible. That level of detail proves the charge is based on facts, not just the owner's frustration.
It creates a paper trail that judges respect. And once that assessment is made, the clock immediately starts ticking. The manager has to ensure that written notice of any deductions is sent to the tenant strictly within the required legal time frame for either state, whether that's the rapid 14-30-day window in Kansas or the strict 30 days in Missouri. Failure here means forfeiting the right to the entire deposit, regardless of how severe the damage was.
And that brings us to step five, timely and compliant deposit returns. The final step closes the loop, prompt return, either in full or with the proper itemization and all the supporting documentation.
And this step delivers tangible benefits for the investor that go far beyond just the refund process. Professional handling maintains the landlord's reputation and minimizes the risk of expensive legal claims. And furthermore, it provides clean, reconciled records for your end-of-year accounting and tax purposes.
So for Kansas City landlords relying on this kind of system, the promise is clear. No legal exposure, clean records, and critically, no delays in re-renting the property. If the deposit process is clean and prompt, the manager can focus immediately on turnover and finding the next tenant, which maximizes occupancy and, ultimately, owner profit. Now let's move into the more sophisticated layer of professional management, how a robust system can anticipate and manage risks that are specific to the local market, going beyond just mere statutory compliance. Let's talk about the Kansas City climate and proactive risk management.
This is where local expertise provides a tangible return on investment. A company like Alpine proactively manages risks specific to cold weather move-ins. They directly link preventative property care to deposit risk reduction. I mean, damage from freezing pipes or burst hot water tanks due to failure. That's a major cause of unexpected repair costs and, inevitably, deposit disputes in this region.
Yeah, if a pipe bursts in the middle of winter, the question becomes, whose fault is it? Was it poor maintenance by the landlord, or was it negligence by the tenant? Like, they failed to set the thermostat high enough or leave a faucet dripping.
Exactly. Proactive measures provide the necessary evidence. Alpine's pre-move-in checks ensure HVAC systems, insulation, and plumbing are all inspected and certified proactively. This verifies that when the tenant moves in, the house is in good working order. It reduces the likelihood of emergency failures that could result in massive property damage.
And the tenant education component seems essential here.
It is. Tenants are educated on crucial local responsibilities like frozen pipe prevention, recommended minimum thermostat settings during extreme cold snaps. This education legally shifts some of that responsibility to the tenant to mitigate damage. If a pipe bursts after the tenant was specifically warned and failed to follow reasonable instructions, the manager has documented proof. That allows them to justly deduct for the negligence under the deposit rules. Without that proactive step, the owner is often liable for all the resulting damage.
So proactive maintenance and clear education can prevent a six-figure emergency repair cost from becoming an unrecoverable legal cost down the line.
Precisely. Proactivity ensures the owner can prove they fulfilled their duty of care, which is the strongest defense against deposit claims.
Let's pivot to data. The source material highlights the importance of continuous data analysis, using lessons learned from operational trends to improve the system. Let's explore the three core lessons from tracking leasing and maintenance trends.
These lessons really demonstrate that the system is iterative. It's constantly improving its own compliance and efficiency.
Okay, lesson one. Early communication about move-outs reduces deposit disputes. This makes intuitive sense, but how does a company like Alpine implement this lesson based on the data they're seeing?
The data showed that when communication about the move-out process, including cleaning standards, documentation requirements, the inspection scheduling, when that began 60 days before the end of the lease, the final condition of the property dramatically improved. When tenants are clear on the rules, they are far less surprised by charges. So the system was adjusted to trigger personalized, proactive communication much earlier. It provides visual checklists, and it restates the differences between wear and tear and damage. This management technique converts a potential dispute into a clean turnover, saving the owner time and legal fees.
That's a huge return on investment for what sounds like a simple process change. Now, lesson two. Thorough documentation prevents misunderstandings about damages. This just reiterates the importance of steps two and four, but what did the data actually reveal?
The data likely showed that for every turnover where the manager used high-resolution photo and video documentation versus properties that only relied on written checklists, the number of formal legal inquiries or tenant challenges dropped by a huge percentage, maybe 70% or more. The cost of generating that thorough documentation is negligible compared to the cost of one successful legal challenge. The lesson confirmed. You cannot over-document the condition of the property. Every single claim deduction must be anchored to multiple pieces of dated objective evidence.
The data just validated that the upfront effort saves exponential hassle later. And finally, lesson three. Seasonal maintenance minimizes unexpected repair costs before turnover. This ties back into our cold weather discussion.
This lesson showed that deferring scheduled maintenance leads to costly emergency turnover repairs, which then create delays and potential deposit disputes if the property is unusable because of the repair. By strictly adhering to a seasonal maintenance schedule, checking HVAC systems, ceiling drafts, proactive plumbing checks, they minimize the risk of a costly repair bill cropping up during that critical 10-day turnover window. This keeps the property rent ready, maximizes investor income, and removes maintenance failure as a potential cause for deposit disputes.
These advanced insights really prove that consistency and continuous data analysis keep their systems sharp. It ensures compliance, profitability, and truly provides a hands-off, legally protected experience for the investor. The system learns from every single turnover to become more efficient. We've covered a tremendous amount of detail today, and I think we've proven that security deposit management is far from simple. It's complex, it's governed by incredibly nuanced and often conflicting state laws in Kansas and Missouri, and administrative mistakes create absolutely crippling legal liabilities for the investor.
We saw the immediate compliance differences, didn't we? The differing caps on collection, the critical procedural requirements of that 14-30-day timeline in Kansas versus the strict 30-day timeline in Missouri, and of course that crucial non-negotiable requirement for holding deposits in a separate federally insured trust account only in Missouri. These subtle details are the difference between a compliant, profitable investment and facing statutory penalties that are two or three times the amount of the deposit itself.
The ultimate non-negotiable takeaway for investors has to be this. Security deposits are not just about money. They are about trust, accountability, and professionalism. They are a strict legal process, and handling them improperly is not a minor accounting error. It is a major compliance failure.
Absolutely. A systematic five-step life cycle, from transparent collection directly into segregated trust accounts, to the expert use of photo and video documentation that's tied to depreciation schedules to distinguish legally between normal wear and tear and excessive damage, it's designed solely to protect the owner. It eliminates subjective guesswork and provides a clear, auditable trail for every dollar and every decision.
Partnering with a professional team ensures every dollar is handled properly. From meticulous move-in documentation to timely, legally compliant refunds. This keeps landlords protected from costly mistakes, and it ensures a smooth, non-contentious relationship with tenants, which really is the secret to long-term investment success in the Kansas City market.
This structured precision is how investors achieve peace of mind and maintain their legal firewall in what is a very challenging dual-state market.
So here is our final thought for you, the investor, to take away today. Since legal requirements necessitate holding deposits in a separate, federally insured trust account, particularly in Missouri, and require strict documentation in both states, what ongoing annual checks should you perform to ensure your property manager is consistently maintaining this legal separation and documentation process? You should always be thinking about oversight and accountability, even when you trust your management partner with the utmost diligence.
A provocative question to close on. Always vet the system, not just the people. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into investor compliance structure.
We'll see you next time.